Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2019 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and former Valley resident John Branch. His new book, The Last Cowboys, debuts today, and it paints a picture of the first family of rodeo, as well as a changing American West. We'll also find out how building a bridge could help solve one Fresno area neighborhood's problems, and we'll learn about a new effort to transform local schools. We begin, though, with a look at the local angle of international affairs. The trade conflict between the U.S. and China is heating up, and while tariffs on the steel and agricultural industries have taken center stage, the conflict has quietly moved into another, less visible sector. Those changes are already affecting businesses, but over time they could impact you and city governments and even undermine state environmental policy. FM 89's Carrie Klein reports on China's disruption of the recycling industry and what it means for the Valley.
Among the warehouses and distribution centers in South Fresno, the calls of egrets, herons, and great horned owls may seem a little out of place. This is a transfer station for Mid-Valley Disposal, one of the biggest trash and recycling collectors in the San Joaquin Valley. These recordings of bird calls help keep pests out of the bottles, cans, and boxes trucked in every day. Joseph Kalpikoff, president of Mid-Valley Disposal, says pest control is especially important now because his property is filling up fast.
You're probably looking at a couple hundred tons of mixed paper.
Just right here in this part of the parking lot.
Yep.
What would this have looked like 6 months ago?
Oh, 6 months ago it was empty.
Kalpikoff is standing in front of a wall of paper bales around 10 feet high, paper that was recycled by hundreds of thousands of residents in Fresno and three surrounding counties. Hundreds of bales like these are sprinkled throughout this transfer station, which used to move bales out within just a few days.
Right now, the market is basically, you know, upset, and it's upside down for recyclers.
Why? Because a new policy in China leaves huge amounts of the U.S.'s recyclables without a destination. Stockpiling them is one response, but permits regulate how many bales can be stacked. If Kalpikoff meets that limit, he may have to start sending them to landfills, something some other companies have already resorted to. In response, some Valley cities are raising fees and re-educating residents on recycling.
Yeah, it's a challenge. It's a challenge for not only us, but the entire industry.
The U.S. prides itself that it recycles about a third of its solid waste. California set an ambitious goal to recycle 75% of its waste by 2020. But the U.S. can't process all that material, so we ship a huge amount overseas. The biggest importer is China, which takes about a third of our scrap materials. But that changed in March. A new policy banned 24 products, mostly paper and plastics, and it cracked down on contamination, which basically means unwanted material. The plastic bags, hubcap, and flip-flop I watch sorters pull off the conveyor belt, those are contamination. China dropped its acceptable contamination rate dramatically from 7% of each bale to just 0.5%.
The contamination level that's coming in on a curbside is averaging between 30 and 40% right now. With the new contamination thresholds, it's a challenge to make that 0.5%.
Most recently, starting on May 4th, China halted importation of all U.S. recycling for 30 days. Why such big changes? The Chinese government claims it's a push for the environment. These policies arose from a program loosely translated as National Sword, which aims to cut down on imports of foreign waste. Adina Adler of the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries says recycling wasn't the main target, but it became a casualty. She says while the policies themselves aren't unreasonable, they were made without consulting the recycling industry.
So, you know, they're done without an understanding of what is the existing recycling technology and how it can produce and to what tolerances.
China's environmental bent began years ago. But Kate O'Neill, a professor of environmental science and policy at UC Berkeley, says the latest move, the ban starting on May 4th, certainly had suspicious timing.
I think the latest has to do more with the current tensions over trade with the Trump administration.
These policies have consequences beyond recycling companies. Here in California, if too many recyclables go to landfills, entire cities could end up in violation of state laws that require waste be diverted away from dumps. O'Neill says this is an opportunity to redesign the entire recycling industry.
It means they have to get a whole lot more creative and really start pushing for better infrastructure at home to recycle a lot of the paper and plastic that we produce.
Some public agencies are making changes. Bakersfield has proposed increasing recycling fees, in part because of China's new policies. Starting in June, the city of Fresno will be re-educating residents on what's recyclable and what's not. The state agency CalRecycle is encouraging regulators to loosen restrictions on how much recycling companies like Mid-Valley can stockpile.
We have bales inside the transfer station.
None of these are fast enough for Joseph Kalpikoff. He's worried about the future. But while he waits for a solution, he may at least buy more bird collars to keep the critters out. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Think for a moment about neighborhoods in Fresno. Okay, maybe you thought of the Tower District or Fig Garden. Perhaps it was Woodward Park or Sunnyside. But what about the area west of Highway 99 between Clinton and Herndon Avenues on the north and Grantland Avenue on the west? Today, it's a checkerboard mix of subdivisions, rural homes, and farmland. And getting across Highway 99 to the rest of Fresno, and over the railroad and Golden State Boulevard and the future high-speed rail line, well, it's a traffic nightmare. FM 89's Laura Tsutsui reports on a new effort that aims to solve some big problems for area residents and give the neighborhood a new identity.
All right, Mikey, you're up next, or first.
Victoria Quesi Jimenez drives across Highway 99 three times every morning. Her commute begins at her home just north of the Island Water Park. She drives across Herndon to drop her son Michael off at school and then drops off her daughter Elizabeth, which requires doubling back under the highway.
And then I go to work, which I take Shaw, so it's a bit of a commute. I mean, not too bad. It's all within proximity, you know, close proximity, but just the commute alone or the traffic alone, it can add a lot.
To get ahead of the traffic, Quesi Jimenez leaves her house nearly an hour before her workday starts.
You know, my commute, according to Google, is 12 minutes to work, and I will sometimes be 30, 35 minutes if there's a train, if there's traffic.
Her neighborhood is situated west of Highway 99 between Herndon and Shaw. In that 2-mile stretch, there are no other streets that cross the highway or the Union Pacific Railroad. Quesi Jimenez says both streets get really congested. She's heard rumors of building streets over or under the tracks and about the long-promised Veterans Boulevard, but she's skeptical.
I wish it came sooner because it would alleviate all this traffic, but the promise, it just seems like it'll never happen because we hear about it every year. I've gone to town hall meetings and hear about it, and it's just there. They always say the same thing, you know, they need funding.
Councilman Steve Brandow represents the northernmost part of that area. He's been trying to make Veterans Boulevard a reality for years. He says it would be a critical piece to improving traffic in the West area and preparing for projected growth along the city's edge.
And what Veterans Boulevard is going to do is it's going to fly over 99, Golden State, and the high-speed rail train track.
Brandow is hoping to get the final $30 million for the project through a grant from the federal government. but it will be a while before the city finds out if they get it. City Council President Esmeralda Soria also represents a big region west of Highway 99 between Shaw and Shields. She hears a lot of complaints about congestion, but she's hoping the West Area Specific Plan will identify other resources the area is missing.
You know, people have to cross over to come to the grocery stores, to come shopping, to go to the doctor, because none of those amenities, I don't even think that they have a dry cleaner west of the 99. And so those are amenities that don't exist, and so people are having to travel across the city.
Mark Stevenson has been a general contractor for over 25 years in Fresno. He says the council members' hopes of better amenities and connectivity are exactly what the area needs.
You can see the area infrastructure east of the 99 is very cohesive and very tight. And you look west of the 99, and it's like an ink blotter waiting to be, you know, drawn. So the West Area Plan is ripe for input from our citizens to develop into a exciting community.
Stevenson predicts that neighborhoods in the area will soon include Silicon Valley employees who are living in affordable Fresno homes and using high-speed rail to get to work. Stevenson already has plans to develop affordable housing west of the highway. The potential improvement sounds exciting, and the investment will be a big deal for the area, but residents are still uncertain of what the outcome will look like. At a recent community meeting, West Area residents raised concerns about the project's timeline and their daily traffic struggles. Brandon White and Samari Palos came to the meeting together. Both say they relate to traffic frustrations. White just moved to the area a few months ago.
But I think what we're dealing with now is a result of poor planning from past city councils. I'm talking about going back 30, 40 years, you know, because they have a long-range plan going out decades, and now we're reaping, you know, the negative aspects of not having a proper plan 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Paulo says it's hard to see longtime residents so frustrated.
It's heartache, and you could hear it today a lot with some of the people that have lived here longer than Brandon and I have come to this community. This is our first meeting, so it was interesting to kind of see the people. Everyone had the same concern at the end of the day.
So will one road or plan make a difference to the area? Michelle Calvarese is the chair of the Department of Geography and City and Regional Planning at Fresno State. She says that it's possible.
I don't think that one particular project is going to make everything rainbows and unicorns in the area. But one road can make a huge difference.
Calvary says that city planning is a political process with a lot of stakeholders, the city, developers, residents. It can be hard to get things done with so many moving pieces and a lot of red tape to work through.
While it may seem frustrating, and it is frustrating, it oftentimes results in a better project.
Right now, the city says the specific plan may take a year to finalize. They'll find out if the Veterans Boulevard project qualifies for federal funding in a few weeks, and it could take a few more months before they find out if they get the money at all. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Perhaps no job in America has been more romanticized and mythologized than that of the cowboy. From movies to songs, much of what we know about cowboys in the American West is often just a caricature of real life. A new book by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist John Branch aims to give us a different sort of look into the life of the Wright family. It's called The Last Cowboys, a pioneer family in the New West. They might be the first family of American rodeo, multi-generational saddle bronc champions. The Wrights are also a contemporary family in the American West, struggling with issues like a changing climate, encroaching development, and financial pressures on the family's cattle ranching business in Utah. It's also a book with a strong local angle, which we'll find out about in a minute. John Branch of the New York Times joins us now on Skype. John, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
John, your book is about the Wright family and their incredible success in rodeo. But as I mentioned in the intro, it's about a lot more than that. How much does cattle ranching fit into this book and the pressures that they're facing off of the rodeo circuit?
It's a significant part of the book. It's really what they see as their future. I mean, they all realize that rodeo is not forever. Even though they are passing rodeo down from generation to generation, there aren't a lot of old cowboys out there, rodeo cowboys out there, especially in bronc riding. And so they realize that they need to figure out what the long-term plan is. And for this family, it's going to be cattle ranching, which is really kind of the two-pronged approach to this book, is that they're trying to build a future through two things that I think a lot of people would assume are not things to build a future around. And that would be, you know, a somewhat small cattle operation and rodeo.
That's going to be the seventh generation of Wrights in that business. But with drought, with climate change, with a lot of other pressures with development and tourism, how are their lives changing away from the rodeo arenas of the American West?
Yeah, it's interesting because you're right. They have been running cattle on that land outside of Zion National Park, what is now Zion National Park, for seven generations. And it's certainly changing. You know, there's been a lot of news lately about the federal land use. The Bundy family has their operation not too far away from where the Wrights are. So the Wrights are very much in the thick of a lot of the changes going on in the West. That is the battles over federal lands or whether or not they should be put more in local or state hands. They certainly have some opinions about that. The climate change and the drought that they have been facing the last few years has really changed their herd. It used to be that they could throw a couple steers or bulls in with the herd at a certain time of year, and 9 months and 10 days later, a bunch of, you know, 90% of the cows would be pregnant. And now those cycles are off, and that's because of the drought, really, and the feed that is struggling because of the drought. All these things that are issues that they didn't necessarily face 10 years ago, 20 years ago, certainly not 30 or 40 years ago.
How big of a deal are the Wrights in the world of rodeo fans, of rodeo followers? I think certainly they're getting a lot of attention with this book nationally for the people who maybe don't follow the PRCA standings every day. But give us an idea how significant they are in their field.
Certainly. I often compare them to the Mannings in football. You know, the Mannings had a father and two sons play NFL quarterback. The Wrights are like the Mannings of rodeo if the Mannings had like five or six more NFL quarterbacks. The Wrights have five brothers that are now professional rodeo cowboys, plus a brother-in-law, a guy who's married into the family. And now the oldest of those boys has three sons that are now professional cowboys. So I guess there are 8, 9 of them. And if you look at the standings in the top 30 or so of Saddle Bronc, you'll see 6 or 7 Wrights.
You write about the injuries that a 2-time world champion Cody Wright has endured during his time in the rodeo arena as a Saddle Bronc rider. And in great detail, you write about those. Does he have worries as a father seeing his sons out there doing the same thing and knowing the type of torture that his body has gone through over the years?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I've covered a lot of sports, and including things like hockey and football, and there's no athlete tougher than, I think, a rodeo cowboy. And that is because largely they don't get paid anything if they don't show up. And so they kind of have to suck it up. And so I think Cody has kind of passed down that sort of, you know, rub dirt on it and suck it up kind of mentality to these boys. Almost everybody in this family at one point or another tried their hand at other rodeo events, including bull riding. And I think the family sees bull riding as just a little crazy. Most of them have realized at the age of 18 or 19 that bull riding is no way to get old. And so they've gone to saddle bronc riding, which is, you know, of the rough stock events, the bull riding, the bareback riding, and saddle bronc seems to be the most sane. That's all relative, though. These guys are getting hurt a lot, and it's rare that they go through a season without some sort of pretty major injury that ends up keeps them in the hospital or puts them in the hospital.
And you write that there's sort of a utilitarian prestige, not your words, but mine, to summarize what you were talking about there with the field of saddle bronc riding. Oh, tell me a little more about that as it compares to those other two entries in the rodeo field.
Yeah, I mean, the family sort of believes by tradition that, you know, the way that horses were broken was you throw a saddle on them and try to break them and make them into useful ranch horses. So they see saddle bronc as kind of the original rodeo sport, and one that actually has a real purpose. You know, nobody would choose to just get on a bull. That's kind of like a parlor game or like a dare or something that came about. Bareback riding, as the name implies, is basically saddle bronc riding without a saddle. And again, that's not something that guys were doing on the ranches very often, became just part of the rodeo scene eventually. So what they see with saddle bronc riding is that it's much more, and I think I describe it this way, it's much more poetry than chaos. There's a rhythm to it. The judges that are judging these events, and these are subjective judges, are judging both the horse and the rider. And the idea is that you are in sync with the horse. When the horse comes out of the gate and lands on its front feet, your feet as a rider are supposed to be high up on the mane of the horse. And then every time the horse goes up and down, your feet are moving in sync, like perfectly timed pistons. So the best rides are not the ones that look like total chaos and, oh my gosh, can you hang on the way bull riding is. The best rides are these kind of simple looking rides of really big jumps.
Did you know much about rodeo before you began this project?
I knew a little bit. I in my past lives, including at the Fresno Bee, covered a little bit of rodeo, and I've always thought it's really a compelling sport to cover because the stories are so great. They're just very raw. The athletes are so accessible. They're happy to talk to you as opposed to maybe some athletes in some sports these days. And not a lot of people are writing about it. And so I think it's just really ripe and it's just so colorful. So I knew enough to know that when this idea came along that I was very interested in it.
You spent an awful lot of time with the Wrights. You mentioned that many rodeo cowboys are willing to talk to the media. What was the initial approach like with them? Were they hesitant to talk to a journalist with the New York Times and have someone follow them so closely for so long?
You know, they're wonderful, and they were not hesitant as far as I could tell. I remember meeting them the first time in Las Vegas and basically saying, we'd love to do a story on you. And they kind of went, yeah, okay, whatever. And so then I just kept showing up. And I honestly think that maybe they are just too polite and too kind to ever tell me no, or what are you doing here? So I just kind of kept showing up, and they kept seeming to be very welcoming and happy to see me. And so that went on for about a year off and on. And I wrote a New York Times story. And then when the book came about, I did it again for another 2 or 3 years. And I still kind of randomly show up in their worlds, and they seem very happy to have me. But you do kind of wonder, you know, are you taking advantage of somebody's kindness? Because they just don't ever say, why are you here again? But yeah, they got very used to me.
We're talking with John Branch, the Pulitzer Prize winner. His new book is called The Last Cowboys, A Pioneer Family in the New West. John, for over a century now, writers have been eulogizing the American West ever since the government declared the frontier closed back in 1890. There's a lot of romanticization of the Old West and of the cowboy lifestyle. How does this family fit into that overarching narrative? Is this another lament of a lifestyle gone and past, or is this something different?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. I think we all have these kind of sepia-toned ideas of what the old cowboy, the old West was. And a lot of that has been framed by pop culture, by movies and by old Western novels and that sort of thing. And I think people who read this will sort of capture that. I think there's a certain nostalgia for it. But I do think it's a fading kind of vestige. And so the Wrights are living in this world of ranching and rodeo that I think a lot of people would be surprised still exists to the degree that it exists. Certainly people in New York, where I work, but I think people all around the country will, you know, if you read this, will think this could have been written back in the 40s. This could have been written back in the 70s, except for the issues that they are confronting today, which are very, you know, 21st century.
In a way, this is also a local book. Not only do portions of the narrative take place in rodeos here in Central California, Oakdale, Clovis, Springville, but there's also a local connection to the genesis of this story. Tell me about the role your former editor at the Fresno Bee played in bringing this project to reality.
Yeah, Charlie Waters was the editor at the Fresno Bee. He's the one who hired me back in 2002. As a sports columnist, and Charlie became a mentor of mine. And I left for the New York Times in 2005, about the time that Charlie left for semi-retirement, and he moved to Las Vegas. And so he and I kept in touch quite a bit. And every time I would go to Las Vegas, I would go have breakfast with him at one of his dive spots on the outskirts of town. And over one of these breakfasts several years ago, he mentioned the Wright family. And Charlie was kind of an old rodeo hand himself. He grew up in Kingman, Arizona. He moved all around the West for various newspapers. So he kind of kept his he had kind of a bent toward rodeo and followed it a little bit. And he told me about this family, the Wright brothers, who were dominating Saddlebronk. And he and I talked about it and thought it could be an interesting story to sort of unpeel the logistics of how a family goes about doing this and how you travel rodeo and what's going on with the dad back trying to build this cattle operation. So I stuck that on the back burner for the New York Times for a year or two until I had a chance to really go out and do it over the course of a year off and on. And that story then ran in 2015. So I've dedicated the book to Charlie. Sadly, he passed away a couple of years ago. So he will never have seen the final product of his idea.
What do you think keeps the family going and so many of these family members continuing to go in this field? Obviously, there's talent. But as you point out, while they have some good winnings and those winnings have been turned back into the cattle operation, as you also point out, the rodeo lifestyle is brutal and also not necessarily always financially fruitful. Is there something else that is propelling them in this rather crazy field, at least to the outside?
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things. One is that they're really good at it, and they see their brothers or uncles be really good at it and make a living at it. And so they think, well, this is something I can do. And for the most part, these boys, especially now the new generation of boys, they're put on horses at the age of two or three. They have they'll put them on bucking horses or bulls at a very young age. And so they kind of grow up with it. What's interesting about the rights, you know, we talked about the 21st century and kind of the urbanization of the West. You know, a lot of these towns across the West, including the kinds of towns where the Wrights live in Utah, are dying towns, and kids don't see a future there in their small towns, or the family ranch is being bought up by corporate interests, and so they're all looking to go to the cities to go find jobs, and the whole way of life is just sort of dissolving. The Wrights are different. For whatever reason, the Wrights have decided, and it's not something that they sat down and talked about, but they have all sort of decided, I think, internally, you know what, we're just going to keep doing what we've been doing. And so these kids grow up, and very few of them have these dreams of moving to the big city and getting a corporate job. They're all thinking, no, I want to do what my dad does. I want to do what my uncle does. And that's rodeo and ranching.
And it sounds like even Bill Wright is, as the patriarch of this family, also open to change. He's looking at a different sort of vision for the future of this cattle operation. How would that play out, and how far along are they on that path?
Yeah, I mean, Bill Wright is kind of the heart and soul of this book in a lot of ways. He's the patriarch here, and he's the one, while the boys are off earning money on rodeo, at rodeos, is trying to keep this cattle operation going and trying to grow it a little bit with the help of their earnings. What's interesting about Bill is that he grew up in that area, right outside Zion National Park, and back when it was very quiet, not a lot of tourists were going to Zion at the time. And he worked for a long time at the Grand Canyon. He would run mule trains down the Grand Canyon. But he's been in that area all his life. And he's been lamenting for many, many, many years how the world is changing around him. And it has just recently occurred to him that instead of running from it, maybe he should try to embrace it. And so he's kind of going back to his roots. This is kind of how the book ends. Spoiler alert. He's kind of going back to his roots, and he's allowing trail rides, and some people have put some like glamping kinds of tents on his property. And he says, you know what, if this is the way it's going, maybe we can sort of make it work both ways.
Do you think he's aware of how this book might also change his family's future?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. We have not sat down and talked about like the potential impact of this book. You know, in my mind, it's just a little book that I wrote. So I haven't thought about it in a broader sense. I suspect he kind of wonders, you know, if somehow the book takes off or something, if it gets more attention. But he is not somebody who is easily frazzled by change. You know, he's a very thoughtful guy, and he's been doing this a long time. And I think, you know, in all those kind of cowboy ways, he just kind of lets the world sort of unspool in front of him, and he deals with it as it comes.
Speaking of lives that are changing through different events from the outside, you yourself, with the Pulitzer Prize for Snowfall, that famous article about the avalanche in the Northwest, that really brought you to just a great attention, even beyond your following in the New York Times as a sports columnist. How has your life changed since that prize?
I'd like to say it hasn't. I suppose, I mean, I say this all the time, that my friends and my family know I'm the same person. And I think they're like, really? You have a Pulitzer Prize? they must just give those to everybody. But I think what has changed is the way people, strangers, perceive me. I probably ruin that illusion when they meet me or when they talk to me. But I think people assume that, you're a Pulitzer Prize winner. That seems to elevate me and maybe open some doors in my own reporting when I call people and they happen to Google me or something. But trust me, it has not changed me. It's not a life changer. I know somebody has said it's one of those things that will now be maybe the first line of your obituary if they still write obituaries by the time I die. But I can't think of any day-to-day way that it has affected me whatsoever. It's a great honor, but it hasn't changed anything in my life.
Before we go, circling back to Charlie Waters, when you look back at the Fresno Bee and even the sports page, maybe even especially the sports page back in the last decade, some remarkable talent came out of that paper and out of the sports department at that time. Andy Katz, Adrian Wojnarowski, yourself. I could go on. What was going on there at that time? What was the secret sauce that had Charlie this to have a special eye for talent, or was it this the Tarkanian era brought a lot of talented, ambitious young journalists to Fresno that went on to great things?
I think people will give Charlie most of the credit for that. I think he had an eye for talent. He was one of those guys who would see a glimmer in somebody and give that person a chance. And whether that person was somebody from across the country who had applied or sometimes even within the newsroom. A lot of people who started at the Bee answering phones as clerks became big-time reporters. I'm thinking of my friend David White, who was answering phones and then eventually went on and started to write for the San Francisco Chronicle. I think that's a lot to do with Charlie and people like Bill McEwen, who was there, and Robert Zizzo, who was a sports editor there for a while. I'm very proud of that lineage. You know, Adrian Wojnarowski was in front of me. John Canzano was the columnist right before me. You know, people like Jeff Passan and Vaughn McClure and David White. You can name a million of them. It was quite an era, and I think the Fresno Bee in that era was as good as any sports section of, you know, a medium size as any in the country.
We've been talking with John Branch, former Fresno Bee sports columnist, now with the New York Times, Pulitzer Prize winner, and his new book is called The Last Cowboys, A Pioneer Family in the New West, telling the story of the Wright family, which has dominated the sport of rodeo, specifically saddle bronc riding in recent years. And also going beyond that in this book, talking about the family's cattle ranching operation in a changing Western lifestyle. John Branch, thank you so much for joining us today.
Honor and a privilege. Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Fresno Unified is one of the largest school districts in the state. It has a tough job. Many students come from families struggling with poverty, and the district has a high percentage of English language learners. Academic performance in many areas lags behind other districts. There have been a number of efforts to improve those numbers over the years. The latest is from an outside group called Go Public Schools Fresno. They just released a new report called Choosing Our Future 2.0, and they're seeking to get the plan approved by the school board. After a long meeting last week, the board delayed a vote on the plan. It has sparked support as well as questions and even some controversy. Joining us now to answer what this plan is all about, we have with us the executive director of the group, Diego Arambula. Diego, welcome back.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
We last spoke with you when you were just kicking off this process to develop this report. Now it's out, and I want to get into the main findings that you have here in the three recommendations. But before that, why is an outside group the one that needs to drive this process to change Fresno Unified? You have a new superintendent. The school board is the elected democratic body that is supposed to represent the needs of parents and voters in the district. Why is an outside group, a nonprofit like Go Public Schools Fresno, needed here?
Yeah, Joe, thanks for that question. I'll start by just noting we're not outsiders. So I grew up here in Fresno, went to public schools here in Fresno. We've got a small team of four who all grew up in the area, went to schools here in the area. We've got a leadership council who are all rooted here in Fresno. And what we've done is brought together parents, educators, and community members to talk about how we're doing in our schools. At a time of transition, the first time we've had a new superintendent in more than a decade, this felt like the right time to bring back what was first done in 2005 with the original Choosing Our Future report. So we asked Superintendent Nelson whether this would be beneficial to the district. He agreed. And so Go Fresno, a local nonprofit, decided to take that charge of engaging educators, parents, community members, in talking about our schools and what we needed to do to move forward.
So essentially, you're a community organizing group focused on education. Community organizing groups usually have a specific mission, a specific agenda to try to advance forward. What is yours with this report?
If you go on to Go Fresno's website, gopublicschoolsfresno.org, you can see our mission is to ensure that every single child has a chance to thrive, both in school and in life. With this report, we wanted to take a really hard look at where we were today so we could authentically level set. And we know so much has gotten so much better in our district, yet we know that still we're far away from where we need to be so that every child can thrive. We then wanted to set up a vision that the community could get behind and then put together some recommendations that could help drive us toward that. And we were so excited to have nearly 800 people engage with us over the last 9 months since you and I last got to sit down together to help shape that vision and to help shape those recommendations.
So let's go ahead and talk about some of these recommendations. You know, in broad strokes, what you're talking about here is not revolutionary. You're talking about improving outcomes, improving student success. But number one, you talk about redefining what success looks like in the 21st century. What does that even mean at this point? Do you go beyond just the broad stroke of talking about that in a general term, or how would you actually redefine success?
All of these recommendations that the community put together and we're putting in front of the board next Wednesday are asking the board to help drive toward these goals. So this recommendation of redefining what success looks like is predicated on two things we heard deeply from the community. The first is that for so many families, they deeply want their children to be academically prepared. Educators agree. Yet everyone agrees that we need more than just academic preparation. So just looking at test scores alone cannot be the only way that we measure success. The second reason that folks wanted to redefine what success looks like is because our old metrics have worked for a workplace that was pretty much the same, yet the jobs of tomorrow are shifting. My daughter's in kindergarten now. 65% of kids who are starting kindergarten this year will work in jobs that don't yet exist today. And so we know that those kids going to schools that look similar to the ones that we went to won't actually prepare them for success. So we know that the first thing the district needs to do is to redefine our measures of success so we know what we're driving
toward. How do you do that, though, when education is so heavily regulated by Sacramento and federal policy as well? Fresno Unified is not an island here, Diego. What, you just come up with a new rubric and say, this is what we're going to do, and we're doing our own thing now?
There are great examples of districts across the country who have done work like this. Just here in California, here in the Central Valley, Lindsay Unified has done some really great work. Now, every district is different, but a small farm-working town of about 4,000 students about 7 or 8 years ago, redefine what success looked like and set a new metric. It doesn't mean that they don't follow state laws, that they don't abide by federal laws, certainly. It just means that they're actually asking more and driving toward more. And so we're excited about Fresno Unified joining along with other districts around the country who are moving in this direction.
So you're also talking your second recommendation here, empowering students and educators with individualized data to, again, assess progress. Is this really like part two of your first one? And how do you individualize data? Doesn't that defeat the purpose of having a standard?
So we know that we need to have a standard that everyone's striving toward by the time that they graduate. So that first recommendation is all about having a clear end goal for all students. The second recommendation from so many of our parents, what we heard, and I'm a parent of two girls who are both in schools here in Fresno, and so many parents and educators talk to us about how unique and individual all of our kids are and how different they all are. And so moving every single one of them lockstep through the same exact curriculum and activities and learning doesn't necessarily reflect what we know about how learning best works, how what we know about where our students are today. And so the second goal is about making sure, as best as we can, that we're meeting each individual kid where they are and growing them as much as is appropriate in any given year.
And then moving on through your recommendations here, get to number three, creating an innovation zone to design and support transformational school models. This is perhaps the most controversial of your recommendations. Revision school models that can further accelerate student growth towards 21st century success. Reading through this, a lot of it sounds like you're backing charter schools. And your background is in charter schools. You ran charter schools in Oakland, and your parent organization in Oakland is also staffed by many people with backgrounds in charter schools. Is this a wolf in sheep's clothing bringing charter schools, expanding them into the Fresno Unified District?
Put simply, no, it's not. And I can appreciate that. I'd love for you to talk to any of our parents, to our educators who have been a part of this. What this report reflects is not me, Diego Arambula. What it reflects is almost 800 Fresnans who came together over dozens and dozens and dozens of meetings over 9 months to do this. And often these national conversations around charter schools or not don't actually seep into what community members, when they get together and are talking about schools, care about. With regards to innovation zone, what so many folks realize is that what teachers and parents want is a chance to empower educators as the decision makers about what's happening and what's best for kids. And in a district as big as ours, what often happens is the district makes decisions that then are forced down to individual schools. And what we are asking for is actually to put that decision-making power back at the school site so that teachers and school leaders together can decide what best works for the kids in front of them.
How would you see that being implemented? Is this district-wide or is it a specific school sites? You cite Jaylee Charter as one example of a successful model. Also CART, the collaboration between Fresno and Clovis Unified, the Center for Advanced Research and Technology. Is this about doing this at all campuses or is it a few experimentation sites?
We also cite Patino Entrepreneurship High School and Design Science as two shining examples inside the district. What we have asked for in the report and what our community has said is that we want to begin moving toward a model like this, but we believe that setting this up as a pilot zone so that individual campuses where we've got readiness and willingness from school leaders and from educators and from the community to move toward this direction is the way to go. So there's no way that you start something like this district-wide. Again, following the great examples of districts like Denver, who has created an innovation zone, you start with a small, selected group of schools where the teachers, the school leaders, and the parents come together, design the school model that meets the needs of those students, and then begin to implement.
So beginning to implement this process, what does that look like? You're asking for a cabinet-level position within the district. It would be staffed by your people. How would that work?
No, with each of these recommendations, what our community was very clear on when they came together and did all of this work is that they recognize that the district and our educators are prime decision makers. And so they wanted to put forth a vision, which is here in the report. And if you haven't read the report, for anyone who's listening, please check out cof.gopublicschoolsfresno.org to read more. But what we've asked for is a vision and to adopt these recommendations. But then the very next step, if they adopt these recommendations, is then to actually put together an implementation plan. How would this work in Fresno Unified? And we recognize that where Go Fresno has been so helpful, a local nonprofit, is in bringing folks together to drive toward this vision and these recommendations. But the actual work of figuring this out, that's the district working alongside Fresno Teachers Association, working alongside parents and school leaders to figure out how do we implement this and how do we make this work here in Fresno.
How do you get the buy-in from leadership then? Superintendent Nelson has said that he's been on board with this project. However, he also told KC24 that he doesn't want to create a new silo within the district. He said that's the last thing he wants to do. How do you get those who are actually in charge and the teachers union behind this? And they've been a little skeptical in some cases.
You know, the leadership in the district as well as the union, these are critical stakeholders, and nothing changes in schools without our educators driving that work. And so we recognize how important the teachers' union is as a critical stakeholder in helping to drive change in this district as well as leadership. And we have continued conversations over months and months with both the Fresno Teachers Association, with district leadership, with board members. We've had parents talking with them, educators talking with them, folks from Go Fresno talking with them to help drive toward and see the value of this vision.
So what's the next step? They delayed the vote last week. When is it coming back?
The board agenda was just released, I believe, yesterday or the day before. We are on the agenda again on May 23rd. We'll be first on the agenda this time so we can make sure that we actually have the time to go through
those famous 11 p.m. School board meetings. avoiding that this time.
For so many of our families who are part of this network, this is one of the first times they're really getting engaged in work like this. And so they had so many questions after last board meeting about what was happening and how we move forward. And so we've worked hard to help them understand that this is a process and that we're back for a vote on the 23rd.
Diego Arambula is the director of Go Public Schools Fresno. They just released a new report called Choosing Our Future 2.0. It's available on their website, and you can read about the recommendations they have as it goes to the school board in a few days. Diego, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
If you're a regular KVPR listener, you're probably familiar with the idea that where you live can influence your health. But just 10 years ago, that field of research was still emerging. One of the first journalists to tackle that issue in depth was Suzanne Bohan, at that time a reporter with the Bay Area News Group. Her four-part series on the subject earned her an award from the White House Correspondents Association in 2010. Last month, she published her second book, entitled 20 Years of Life: Why the Poor Die Earlier, and How to Challenge Inequity. FM89's Carrie Klein interviewed Bohan about the book and how it builds off her newspaper career.
I had been reporting for years on lack of access to health care, how new clinics improved health, and how getting health insurance to people is the key. But this was a whole new way of looking at health, and it made so much sense because about 15% of the disparities in lifespan and disease in the nation is attributed to lack of health care, actually. It's a surprising statistic, but it really is borne out. But that much of it comes from creating healthy conditions. And an example is, for example, how we created clean water systems in the early 19th century and had other public sanitation campaigns, and that profoundly improved life expectancy. That wasn't about what a doctor could give you. And this is expanding that philosophy into creating healthy communities with parks that people can use and feel safe doing so, walking paths, better grocery stores, better schools, and so on.
And so the book is called 20 Years of Life. Tell me about where that title comes from and what it means for our health, putting all of these different factors together.
It points to the 20-year lifespan difference that commonly exists between nearby neighborhoods, and it's based on usually it's wealth, inevitably, although it's not simply income. There's other factors. But more importantly, in the title, it describes a roadmap for how to challenge this kind of inequity in lifespan and disease rates by building up political power and in creating cohesion among community organizations who are working on similar problems. And it's very important for me in reporting that where possible, I want to describe what's going on to fix an issue rather than simply focusing on the issue. I don't think that's very helpful for people. We all know there's a lot of problems. What really is important is what's being done constructively to address it. And in fact, this book is very much a blueprint for any community wanting to change conditions.
And explain a little bit more how these conditions actually play into health. I mean, as you say, health can really vary dramatically by zip code. It can vary by as much as 20 years when you're looking at life expectancy. You say it relates back to chronic stress and social determinants. Before we kind of get into challenging these issues, just where does health research stand when it comes to understanding the causes of these disparities?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And they've done studies showing that lack of access to a park You know, naturally, the youth who do not have access to a park simply are not involved in sports as much, and that's, of course, very health-promoting. And in fact, one study showed that 50% of all the really healthy activity of heart, you know, the high cardiovascular activities entail using a park. And if a community does not have that, then they're missing out on that benefit. And also the diets. You study the diets of people in these communities, and they simply don't have access to grocery stores and so on. And the studies also show that naturally when you have access to a grocery store, you are going to make better choices. And when there are fewer fast food outlets around or liquor stores and more options for healthy food, you're going to make the right choice. So it's really quite unfair to say these people are making bad choices when they simply don't have the same menu of options that wealthier communities have. And there's also policies that mitigate against these communities that allow, say, heavy industry to exist in their midst or diesel trucks to drive through their communities, leaving particulates, whereas, as I cite in the original newspaper series, there's one community in the East Bay that banned diesel trucks, is an affluent community, and their roadways, but that meant that more were going through poor communities. So they're fighting against those kinds of policies as well that make their communities less healthy.
So, as you said, you know, this book really isn't so much about the problem, which is these health disparities and the social determinants that play into them, but it's really about this vast California experiment started in 2010. It's called Building Healthy Communities, which many people are probably familiar with, and it's a project of the California Endowment. How did it come about? How was it started in 2010?
It really ultimately started with a vision of the CEO of the California Endowment, Dr. Robert Ross. He's a pediatrician. And in 1984, fresh out of medical school, he started working at a clinic in Camden, New Jersey, and I profile this in the book. And it was right at the height of the crack epidemic, or when it was emerging, I should say. And he was just devastated by these premature births he was attending to with, you know, two-pound babies. And he realized he couldn't fix. His medical training had not equipped him to deal with this onslaught of illness that he was seeing inside this Camden clinic, and that he was patching people up and sending them back into sick communities, the ones that created these conditions. And so he switched his focus to healing communities, as he said, rather than simply healing patients. And he became a public health director. He went back and got a master's in public administration and took over health departments in Philadelphia and San Diego, and then joined the California Endowment as its CEO. And the board of directors of the endowment agreed with his vision, and they fully supported it. And they really gambled on this when they started in 2010, because they were giving all of their grant giving, which is about $200 million a year. And they just decided to gamble on this project of concentrating on building political power and cohesion among nonprofits and passing laws and policies to fix conditions. And they, as I said, they don't spend a nickel on the provision of health care. They concentrate on changing conditions in the community.
And so what does building healthy communities actually look like on the ground? You know, how many communities is it involved with? What sort of groups? And how are they doing this grassroots work?
That's a great question and a very important question, because the logistics of it is all important. It's 14 communities. It ranges from South LA and City Heights and San Diego, Oakland, Richmond, Kern, Merced, Fresno, and up to Del Norte County in the far north. And what makes it work is there's the presence of some paid staffers, some from the endowment who already lived in the community. So they were well known to the community, and that was critical. You can't have outsiders coming in and trying to start up this campaign. You have to have people who are known and trusted in the community. And then they take some of the community leaders and they create what's called a hub, and that's a staffed position also. And then they provide all manner of resources in terms of research and polling data and holding convenings and meetings. With these community organizing meetings, a really critical factor of what makes them work to have people come out after a long day of work to speak at a city council meeting or plan a campaign is they provide a dinner, you know, a buffet dinner there, and they provide child care. So people don't have to stress that part of the equation, which is a major factor for a busy person working. The beauty of it also is when people start to work together and collectively start to make a difference, they feel like this new sense of power in their own life. I've seen it time and time again, from youth to adult, they just are amazed that they have these successes against powerful, you know, entities. The city council passed a law that they envisioned, and they actually got it done. And it, you know, changes their life and their sense of possibilities, and also creates much more neighborhood cohesion. So people are getting to know each other, and that's also a powerful form of health promotion.
This Building Healthy Communities program, of course, is not just responsible for making people feel more cohesive and increasing a community feeling. I mean, it's actually having very real impacts within these communities, right? And within, you know, within the legislative environment here in California.
Yes, it is. And I think to give some concrete examples would be helpful. And one of the most impactful, there's so many. In Fresno, there's been some very powerful changes. And one was a campaign that started by Sarah Reyes out of the Fresno, California Endowment Office. She's known to many people there as a former assembly member, and she joined the California Endowment, you know, years back. And she was the one who pressed Bob Ross, when the CEO of the endowment, to include on the agenda with a board meeting that was going to be held in Fresno, youth speaking about unfair school disciplines that were pushing them out of school. They were saying there's not a dropout problem, there's a push-out problem, and it made the kids, you know, fearful for their future. And Sarah managed to get that on the agenda. And they were very reluctant initially to have young people speaking to the trustees of a, you know, multi-billion dollar foundation. They were given a strict 30-minute limit, but they were so taken with them, the trustees, that they kept them there for an hour, posed with photos with them afterward, exchanged business cards. And that was the genesis for a statewide campaign that reformed school discipline practices in California that's directly linked to this Building Healthy Communities initiative. And there are now 11 new laws passed in California, with another one pending, to reduce suspensions and expulsions in California. And again, it all originated out of that original Fresno vision. And it's resulted in 330,000 fewer suspensions last year compared with, I think, 5 or 6 years earlier. So that's one concrete example. And it's working so well that they're actually going to continue it. It was going to sunset in 2020, and a lot of these community organizations that are supported by it were going to have to seek other funding elsewhere, and they were all planning on that. But the word is out that the board of the directors of the California Endowment is saying, this is working so well, why would we stop it? It's making a profound and lasting change, and it's not just in the 14 communities, but it's actually statewide.
And as you said, these are just some of the of over 500 new policies and laws that have arisen out of building healthy communities.
Correct. And I can give a brief one in Fresno. I mean, I could spend an hour just describing all the various successes. But there was one in Fresno. People came out, you know, 300 people showed up to a city council meeting in 2012. And that started what began a major campaign to improve quality of parks and the number of parks in the south and west side of Fresno, which had about 1 acre of parkland per certain number of population versus almost 5 in the northern part of Fresno. So there was a severe lack of park access in the south and west, and they were also dangerous fields. People, kids would talk about spraining their ankles running on the soccer fields and so on. And it's been incredible. They've gotten, you know, huge resources into a new parks master plan that's examining the south and west and opening up new options and quality of the fields there. And they've also had a agreement with the school district that opened up almost 400 acres of parkland on the weekend to residents. And that's just the beginning of the work there in Fresno.
Well, and so this book really covers so much ground. You know, it covers these health disparities, social determinants of health. And then, of course, it really chronicles this huge Building Healthy Community program and all this Cal Endowment funding through California. You know, what do you want your readers to walk away with, having read this book?
I want them to walk away with the concept that there are, in so-called bad neighborhoods, they are filled with really good people who want a better life like everybody else in this country. And it's a message for philanthropy as well, to fund change, not charity. Charity is, you know, the funding dries up and the conditions are ultimately the same and people are disillusioned that another program came and went. But this is about funding change by bringing in these distressed communities into the mainstream political process and giving them a seat at the table, and so their concerns and their voices are heard along with everybody else.
Great. Well, Suzanne Bohan, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Carrie.
Suzanne Bohan is a health and science journalist in the Bay Area. Her book, 20 Years of Life, Why the Poor Die Earlier and How to Challenge Inequity, was published last month. And in the interests of disclosure, the California Endowment is also a funder of Valley Public Radio. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore, reminding you to visit our website, kvpr.org, for our podcast, audio archives, and much more. You can contact us there as well, kvpr.org. And we'd like to send a special welcome to our brand new addition to our team, Monica Velez, our new reporter, joins us starting this week from the Merced Sun Star. You'll start to hear her reporting on this station. We're very pleased to have her with us. Joining our team of producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, audio engineer Marv Allen, reporters Carrie Klein and Christina Lopez, and production and operations manager Don Weaver. I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2019 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.